showed a picture of a reaper in binary, can't remember it. I'm old enough to remember it. Not only that, the one I started with had horses, not tractors, in front of it. And we were, in 1945, my father would be happy to harvest 2 acres a day, not harvest, cut it as the first process of harvesting, and he'd have 10 people in the field to do that. My son now, and he doesn't have the biggest combine in the world, is disappointed if he doesn't get 50 acres done with him and two sons, and to his two sons to do it. So the productivity of agriculture in my lifetime has been spectacular. From being food being some 50% of GDP, it's now less than 10%. Probably no factor has driven the consumer market more successfully than the switch of consumer spending from food to non-food. I'm a historian as well as a farmer, and my view is that the 19th century was far more interesting than the 20th century. Far more change, transformation and change, took place between 1814 and 1914 than took place between 1914 and 2014. Think about it, about cars, about movement, about communication, all of that. The world was completely unrecognizable. And the Reverend Malthus started his tale of woe in the 1780s, where he said it was all up. And by 1928, the Malthusian Society shut down. And that was because of what had happened in the 19th century, where the population of the world doubled in that period, I think, and starvation was dramatically reduced. Not excluded, but starvation was a rampant possibility in 18th century England when he was writing. Starvation was a thing of the past by 1928. And in the last 70 years, my lifetime, of course, the population of the world has trebled, and we are still feeding ourselves very successfully. And why is that? Thanks to three factors: the scientists, the botanists, the chemists, the geneticists, people like Sir John Lawes, who created artificial fertilizers at Harpenden in the middle of the 19th century. The agricultural engineers, who I think probably played a much greater part in this than the scientists, no harm to you scientists, people like John Deere, McCormick, Ford and Ferguson, and the farmers themselves, because during that period, particularly in North America, farm structures changed, enabled farmers for the first time, not landowners, farmers, to raise the collateral to invest in the new technologies and the new sciences. And there were two big drivers of this progress. The first one was those who saw opportunity, and that was the Americans who saw the opportunity arising from railways, and the engineers, the railway engineers, and the agricultural engineers, who transformed food production in a very short period, between about 1850 and 1890. The world was changed dramatically. And the other was that of necessity. And that is a much more recent driver. It came really after the Second World War. We didn't learn the lessons of the First World War, where we nearly starved in this country. In the Second World War, we did learn it. And as a result of that, the governments poured huge amounts of money out of necessity in order to incentivize increased food production, irrespective of cost and, to a large extent, irrespective of side effects. So where are we today? On the issue of necessity, George and others have mentioned that global demand for food is rising faster than ever. Population is increasing, and moreover, we are suffering meat-eating affluence, which is creating a huge pressure on food supplies. But I do believe that despite the efforts of some of my farming friends, there is not a security issue with Britain as long as we stay in the European Union. I think that is slightly propaganda on their behalf. There is a security issue elsewhere, but I don't think there's a security issue here. Production increases in Britain have slowed down, as we've seen. Part for various reasons, understandable reasons. 30 years ago, when Peter Walker was Minister of Agriculture, he said food from our own resources and almost produced at any cost. And the farmers did, and it became an embarrassment, and the food mountains across Europe were a consequence. So the EU changed their position and actually introduced incentives to cut production rather than to increase production. Imports in this country have risen over those 30 years. Self-sufficiency has reduced from about 70% in food to, I think, probably less than 60% now. We have to remember, in 1939, it was 30%. So we had moved very substantially in that period, before the Second World War. people didn't talk about food self-sufficiency because the supply coming from the Commonwealth and from America was so substantial. So that has changed, and more regulation has been increased very dramatically over the last 30 years. A lot of it necessary, let's be clear, a lot of practices which were taking place in agriculture 30 years ago would be unacceptable today, and rightly so. But, of course, the pendulum may have moved. That, of course, has affected yields. It is interesting that in my farm, we grew 4 tonnes of wheat in 1984. We've only grown it right across the piece, only done that twice since then. I was walking around the farm this morning. I said, this may be the year we're going to beat it a third time. But a lot can happen between now and July and August. But things, despite the botanists tell me that their yield increases are 1% per annum, that means that increases, the total yield should have gone up by 30%. It hasn't gone up at all. I think the less progressive farmers are probably catching up, but the progressive farmers haven't seen much progress in this period. And, of course, farmers have also been faced by rising input costs, substantial increases in costs of chemicals, fertilizer, and all, and they've begun to farm, as they should always have done, to make profit rather than to be yield. And if you are in the business of making profit, yield doesn't necessarily produce the best answer. There are, of course, some areas where productivity is increasing, somewhat controversially, in terms of intensive livestock production, and I'll come back to that. So what in the light of these developments should our priorities be today? First of all, a necessity, getting farmers in the developing world to produce more for themselves, mainly by using, mainly by using technology and science, which is well recognised, getting it to them to use. And the problem there, it isn't easy, because it requires a huge transformation of farm structures in the developing world. More cooperation between them so that they share their buying resources and their capital resources. Fewer bigger farms, which people don't like because they say that's going to create all sorts of rural problems. But it happened in the 19th century in Europe, and it will happen. It will happen. It is happening in China, in India, and it has to be managed rather than resisted. And that way they will resist, they will create the collateral they need to do what they have to do. But they also need to develop new sciences and technologies. And that's where the British research centres come into play, because we have a huge resource, which I think primarily is going to benefit people outside this country rather than inside this country, in developing techniques to technologies to cope with existing problems of weather change and future problems as a result of climate change. Closer to home, in this country, it seems to me the biggest opportunities are going to be on the mechanical engineering and computer side rather than the science side. Farmers are going to adapt precision farming. Precision farming is spectacularly exciting in the way it will work. Satellite imaging, enabling farmers to use far fewer inputs than they use at the moment in order to get more effective yields, to differentiate input, your application of input according to the different behaviour in small areas of a field. As you can do across a field, I've seen images showing variations of yield from 1 tonne to 5 tonnes in the same field, and getting that technology to understand and to master that. That is another huge problem is soil compaction, probably held back things substantially the last 30 years. With satellite mapping, you can tramline your tractors so that they go up the same route, up and down, all the time, and 90% of the land they don't touch. And soil compaction is something one increasingly hears about as a great problem. Another great technological breakthrough, not so much for farming, but for food manufacturing, is in robotics. I used to employ some 5,000 people putting sandwiches together. We invented the first sandwich in Marks and Spencer 30 years ago, and we put it together in a medieval way, and they still do it in a pretty medieval way, with lots and lots of women, mainly because men can't do it properly, placing the tomatoes and the cheese, all the bits in the sandwich, making sure the corners are filled, all that sort of stuff. Robotics are going to do that in the next 20 years, and the impact that that is going to have on our society is beyond belief. Rothamsted, of which I'm a trustee of the Law's Trust, has got a project, what they call 2020, which is 20 tonnes of wheat per hectare by the year 2020. Far be it for me to say that it is ambitious, but it is bloody ambitious. And I rather believe that the priorities, while it's good luck to Rothamsted, I suspect that the priorities should be elsewhere. It's a good it's a good incentive, but I don't think it's going to be, it doesn't deal with the real problem. A cynic would observe that before Norman Borger did all his great work on Mexican wheats, short-stemmed wheats, not much progress in yields had taken place since Turnip Townend in 1780 until 1960. Not a lot had happened. Huge changes then took place, thanks to Borger, between 1960 and 1985, where yields went up from 1.5 tons to 4 tons in the best farms. Not much has happened since. So Borger is an incredible phenomenon in the way food production has developed in the last 100 years. I think one of the big priorities for scientists today is actually to deal with the unintended negative consequences of scientific development of previous years. And a lot of scientists would admit that a lot of the technologies that were seen to be good 30 years ago are now seen to be flawed. Plants are becoming more resistant to sprays and chemicals than they were. Animals are going to become more resistant to antibiotics than they were. That's a huge priority, I think, for the farming world. Waste has been mentioned. Waste is a great obsession of mine. It's bothered me for many years to mention about the waste in hospitals, which is just a spectacular figure. But wherever you go, waste fits into two categories. One is waste created in the developing world by food which never gets out of the fields. Waste, food which is lost unnecessarily because the farmers haven't got the technology, to the resources, the machinery to harvest, to cultivate and harvest the thing in time, and above all to store the infrastructure to take it from farms to places where it can be sold. It is an irony. Somebody in this audience said to me the other day that when you go to Kenya, you're amazed by the multiplicity of mobile telephones and the absence of anything to do with production, mechanical production in the same place. It's a very great irony that mobile telephones seem to play a bigger priority in our society than actually things which produce good food successfully. In the developed world, of course, the waste of food is obscene. Most of it is in domestic homes, apart from the hospitals. But some 30% of the food that we buy in our shops, we never eat. And why don't we do it? We order too much because we get taken away by the bog-offs in the supermarkets, and we can't deal with them when we get home. We eat too much at any rate, so we should start cut out that, in my view, is waste. We throw away far too much, either through ignorance, because we don't know how to make up the yesterday's meal into another meal today, which people of my generation, that was the way you did it, a joint on a Sunday, with luck, keep you going through till Tuesday. Now, if a joint's not finished on a Sunday, it's slung away. And that is true. People sling away food in that way. So it's ignorance, indolence, or neurosis, because the neurosis creeps in with the obsession with these absurd shelf-life codes. And I'm to blame, because Marks and Spencer ourselves introduced them 30 years ago. I wish I never had, because they have become a complete license for people to get concerned about themselves. And most of the shelf lives are not necessary, because food tends to tell you what if it's wrong. Some food doesn't, fish doesn't, cooked meats don't, I agree with that. But milk, sure. Milk is. I eat yogurt, which is a month out of code, and I eat it with great pleasure. Sometimes I don't, because it's bubbling a bit, so then I know. Waste in supermarkets, restaurants and factories is also far too high. And that is because of bad scheduling. That supermarkets order too much from their suppliers and then cancel it, so therefore it's left. And suppliers are second-guessing the supermarkets, and they're making ahead of time and finding they're overdone. And a vast quantity of waste. Blemishes are rejected. Perfectly good food is rejected by the supermarkets because the customers won't pick it up off the shelf because of the blemish. There is a huge computer operation potential. We've made progress on scheduling of food ordering through the system in the 40 years that we started all this 40 years ago. But we're only at the edge. I want to see a situation where as soon as a customer buys a product in a store, at that moment, that information is telegraphed immediately once it goes through the immediately back to this factory in which it comes, so that we can start creating an order for 6 days ahead because of the behaviour of that particular customer at that particular time. This is where robotics are going to really take over. We won't need human beings to think it out, because a human being couldn't think out the consequences of that in the way the supply chain will work. So that's enough about waste. Now, the other issue is food-related health problems. There seems to me that the Today programme, by obligation, must have a health story in a headline every day. Most of them entirely spurious and valueless, usually with so-called research indicates from some institution I've never heard of, which has not been verified by anybody, which suggests that the end of the world is nigh and the next product you're going to eat. The latest one I see is orange juice, that orange juice is now a threat to us all. I have to say, there are serious aspects of this. If researchers go down this line, there are serious issues about diet. Of course there are. Sugar and fats. I'm not arguing that. But if you go down the route, oh, everything is a scare, the public gets switched off. And then you are self-defeating. The people shrug their shoulders and say, well, these guys are just doing it to make money out of it for themselves. So I think that the researchers need to catch hold of themselves to make sure. And the real issue with diet is that we eat too much and we don't travel, we don't take enough exercise. If we do that, if you eat properly, eat the proper amount, take a lot of exercise, and if you take a lot of exercise, the number of calories people consume is actually halved in the last 100 years. But we've become much more sedentary, so our reduced exercise is much greater than our reduced calorie intake, and we need to reduce that calorie intake before. So what can the government do? I'm getting to the end of it now. What can the government do to tackle the possible food crises of the future? First of all, reduce barriers to food trade across the world. There are still far too many barriers, and food is a particularly sensitive issue. I noticed in the report that the government produced, they mentioned a company I'm a director of, JSR Farms. We export pigs for breeding to China, and this is seen as a heroic gesture, patriotic gesture, but it is heroic. You don't make much money out of it, but it's heroic. And the lessons you learn from moving something like a live animal, a high-quality live animal, to a country like China, in terms of the regulatory obstacles, the problems you have to overcome, are nightmarish. And a huge priority for governments all over the world is to make food move more freely from the areas which have got surpluses to the areas which are in shortage, so that the Chinese particularly are, they're even more neurotic than we are about food, which is taking something, but they've sort of banned New Zealand milk products at the moment and British milk products. I think somebody sells 5 tons of cheese from here to China every year. He's been stopped because there's some bug found in his factory 3 years ago. This sort of thing is creating the problems that we need to put right. We need to get the right balance. George mentioned regulation on food regulation, promoting responsible science-led regulation, and outlawing practices which might seriously endanger people. But we've lost a lot of public trust thanks to BSE and other issues which are still in people's minds, GM2, Frankenstein food, all of that. And as long as we have that, you will get regulatory demands from the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail always talks about being against regulation. It promotes more regulation in the minds of their readers than anybody else does. Right, on the report itself, I think it is full of noble aspirations. There's nothing new about that, and that's as it should be. People should always ask more than they're going to get. It is, seems to me, a little bit too complacent and a bit too self-congratulatory. I don't think we're as good at food as we think we are. I think there's a lot of shortcomings in the way we go about innovation. Certainly, the French are streets ahead of us when it comes to food innovation, and always have been. Partly necessity, because they've always had more food to produce than they could consume, so they had to innovate in order to market. The UK business record, and this isn't just doesn't apply to food, in backing investment in research and in training, which are key points in this report, is lamentable. And I see this from the work and the local enterprise partnerships, the difficulty of getting business people to really sign up to a belief in long-term investment, because this is what we're talking about, long-term investment in research and in training is something that we have a huge competitive shortcomings on, whether it's against the Americans, whether it's against the French, whether it's against the German, and we need to put that right if we can do. Finally, the variability of farm performance always strikes me as being spectacular. The difference between a well-run farm and a badly run farm is enormous. In any other industry, those badly run farms would go to the wall and would disappear. In this industry, for some reason, they go on, partly because land values are so high and there is a cushion, partly because people think farming is a way of life, and it is to an extent, but it's also a business. And that variability, overcapitalized, excessive use of labour, high costs, either too big, some of the farms I go to, 7,000, one of the directors of 7,000 acres is a bit too big, and in cereal farming now, if you're less than 1,000 acres, you're a marginal operator. There are huge amounts of structural things wrong in our farming, not just in the world's farming, which have to be put right. Thank you.